Please be advised that this podcast contains graphic descriptions of drug use and could be triggering for some people. Hello, Australian true crime listeners. This is a little something extra for you. It's a reissue of an episode of my other podcast, The Nitty Gritty Committee, in which I talk to people I just find interesting for one reason or another. We true crimers have spoken a lot about methamphetamines in the context of various other stories lately, so I thought it might be a good idea to share Luke Williams' story with you. He's a journalist whose style could be described as full immersion. He once decided he wanted to learn more about the meth scene, and he ended up addicted and destitute. This is Luke's story.
So I moved into a house in 2014 in Pakenham, which is in the outer suburbs of Melbourne, with a guy who was a drug dealer who I knew through his ex who I'd gone to school with.
Wow.
And just prior to that, I'd been working in law, and I hated it. And it seemed just so bland and boring and stuffy, and even still most of my money was going on my rent every week.
Yeah.
I was working 12 hours a week. Everyone was very polite and nice and everything looked good.
Yes.
But to me it just felt like kind of a form of slavery.
Well, yeah, I bet. Did you have that moment that a lot of us have in our 20s where we go, oh, is this it? Is this life? I've got the job. I've got a place to live. I've got a suit or whatever. Is this it?
Yeah, what
life?
Have I feel like I've ticked all the boxes, but I still don't feel fulfilled. I did, but I had that already in my 20s, and that's why I did law, because I was originally working in radio, and I kind of got to a point where I was kind of like, I feel like I've achieved everything I'm supposed to, and it's still not enough, so maybe I'll go what in my mind was the next step up, which is doing a law degree and being even better at being middle class sort of thing. And then when I did all that, it still didn't happen for me. And so I realized that what I really loved about working in the media years and years ago was the reporting and getting out and about and not being office bound all day and all the weird and wacky people that I meet. But I'd also had a long history before that of having psychotic episodes and drug addiction and intravenous drug use.
Okay.
And that I just always kept secret.
So that was even more risky for you to go and move into the meth house.
What are you trying to say? I feel like you're criticizing me.
No, genuinely, I think you're incredibly brave.
Oh,
I'm
thank
trying
you.
To get to your bravery and to your like commitment is astounding. That most of us go, okay, I'm interested in that. Mm. I want to read about it. I want to know about it. Very few of us will go, I'm going to immerse myself in that, right? And so for you to do that, chasing the story of meth addiction and meth use in Australian suburbs with a background of drug addiction that you had already conquered is incredible. It's incredibly brave.
Well, I mean, thank you. I really do. I mean, I don't know if it was really that brave though, because I didn't realise it was going to go as wrong as what it had.
And I
lived with this guy before.
Okay.
And I, years and years ago, and we'd used meth back then every so often, and I hadn't got addicted.
Okay.
But what I didn't know, and I think this is important to say, is what we have in Australia now is crystallised meth.
Yes.
And we've had that in the last 5 years.
What was it before that?
It was powdered meth mainly.
Right.
Since about the late 80s. And in the 90s, we called it speed.
Yes. Okay. I was using speed in the 90s.
Well, that's actually meth.
Yes, right.
That's
I kind of knew
meth.
That, but I didn't realise, I've never seen meth, so I didn't realise that, okay, that's the difference.
Yes,
this
so
is crystal.
We started calling it meth about 2000, 2001 when it kind of entered the media lexicon.
Yes.
And we still called it meth all the way up till 2011 through to 2016, through to now.
Uh-huh.
But what we have now on the market mainly is crystallised meth.
Okay.
And that's coming mainly from China.
Ah, and so that is different how? In terms of that's more addictive?
Well, the purity's risen about 5 times.
Wow.
So you can imagine what it was like on speed, or if you haven't taken speed, which is powdered meth, it's a bit like driving in a really fast car.
Mm-hmm.
5 or 10 times faster than that, you can you can imagine what that.
Yes.
Maybe you can't. It's certainly hard to describe.
The last time I used speed was when I was working as a receptionist in brothels. I was doing night shifts. I was hating it. I was obviously exhausted, but also I was just sick of it, and I was hating the clients. Any man who came to the door, I just want to punch him. I just hate, right? And so I started using speed again during that period of time, and it made me friendly. It made me awake. It made me energized. It put this smile on my face. It stayed there all night. I couldn't do enough for you. So that was kind of the way speed affected me. How would meth compare to that? Five times more than that. What is that?
Well, five times more than that is, for me, it's getting a trophy. It's having someone very attractive tell you that they're also attracted to you and taking off in an aeroplane at the same time.
Okay.
And then a whole lot of memory potholes about what you're actually doing when you're on it.
So super confident.
Super confident, super happy, super friendly at first, but then you start to think to yourself, I'm actually better than you. I am better than you. I don't want to say it, but you know it, don't you? You're sitting there secretly thinking it. So you start
to feel... they're sitting there thinking, I am better than you.
Yes, exactly.
And we all know it.
So you have that grandiose psychosis.
Everyone's got it. Everyone in the room, potentially, has got the grandiosity going on.
And people become very individualised. Unlike ecstasy, which floods your brain with serotonin, crystal meth floods your brain with dopamine, people become very individualised. And it's interesting you should say that you use speed to help you get through work, because that's what people use crystallised meth for as well. And it's been used traditionally by a lot of working class people on factory line, because it makes you engage in repetitive behaviour, limited amount of feelings, you don't need to go to the toilet. So it's the perfect drug in a way for people to work on, and that's why I'm very skeptical when people tell me, but I'm a functional user. I say, but you're not a robot, you're also a human being, and the drug has been used historically, so people become work slaves in a way.
Yeah, and famously we all think we're functioning, and we all start to think, God, why is life so hard, and why is everything going wrong for me all of a sudden? The only thing that's right is the drug. Thank God I've got that, because everything else is chaos. It takes a long time to understand that that drug is creating all of that chaos. Did you find that?
I did, but
broken relationships,
I was so...
broken microwave, broken car, broken, you know?
Yeah, and missing teeth and scabs all over your face in the case of the people that I was living with.
Yeah.
Yes, but I think that for me it was even more extreme because, so my grandfather's got schizophrenia.
Wow.
He committed suicide because he was so psychotic, and so do several of my uncles.
Oh, the poor, poor
my dad's
man.
Got bipolar. But me, I'm perfect. So there we go. Isn't that a shame? No. So what I found is that as soon as I had crystal meth, I became very psychotic in a grandiose way. But I was also having these rolling visions in my mind where I would start to just have little flickers of something. Oh, it's a Roman Empire back 2,000 years ago, but they were in Australia and they found all this evidence. And the people who are actually running the society were people from Mardi Gras who I met 3 weeks ago. But I knew this wasn't true. I knew it was psychosis, right?
Yes.
Well, it was hallucination. And so I've started penning this down and going, oh, this will be great, because I've moved in here to write a book about Drongo, who I've moved in on. But that's not as interesting, because now I can actually write this sci-fi novel and use drugs at the same time.
Great.
Win, 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 win.
Yes. And I'll pump it out in days because I'm not sleeping.
I wrote 8,000 words in one night.
Wow.
And then all those fantasies just sort of became sexual, and I went and masturbated for 16 hours. And I found whenever I tried to will those visions back again, I couldn't do it as much as I tried. And then some of those people who I'd met at Mardi Gras, who I really liked, I started thinking they were contacting me via telepathy.
Wow.
And they were saying to me, because some of them were performers and musicians, they were saying to me, you have not fulfilled your destiny to be a rapper. And I was like, oh, yeah. Because my dad plays the drums and I write poetry in high school, and Australia doesn't really have gay rappers. And you know, I'm pretty street and, you know, whatever, you know, I live in the outer. So, yeah, it makes perfect sense, except for the fact that I'm not musical in the slightest.
No sense at
but
all.
It was illogical. And I was like, yes. So I thought, and so I kind of took everyone aside one day. I go, listen, I'm not going to explain how I've come to this conclusion because you think I've gone crazy, but I've decided I'm going to become a rapper, and I'm going to spend this time using crystallized meth. I didn't know it was crystallized meth. Using meth, ice, whatever. I can't remember what we're calling it. And I'm going to become this wacky, subversive gay rapper that's just going to shock everyone, especially anyone who's ever been nasty to me, because they're going to be so jealous of my talent. So I thought I was on this thing called The Journey. And that all these people who I'd met at Mardi Gras who were performers had been put on this journey by this guy living in London.
Mm-hmm.
And he, like, was some kind of witch or something, and he sparks something in your brain, and then you suddenly realise that you're going to become this artist.
So what happens when you're in this world that you're describing and somebody from outside of that world tries to communicate with you, like your mum, say?
Oh, shut up, mum. What would you know? You've never fostered my musical talent sort of thing.
Yeah.
So it was like that. I became so grandiose where I was like, it's everyone else's fault around me that how could I have got to age 34 and not realise that I had this talent? It's because I've been surrounded by people who have constantly put me down, constantly jeopardised me. My parents didn't foster my talent. People have been jealous of me their whole life and so on and so forth.
Wow. These are all the things that we fear about meth addicts. This is why meth is such a terrifying drug.
It really is.
Because it feels like you could kill me for not believing in your talent at the time.
Yes, but the reason I actually became homicidal is because...
Become homicidal.
Oh, no, hang on a second. Let's not go throwing allegations around.
Okay, sorry.
All right, I did become homicidal. Okay. You got that out of me.
Okay.
But I'm homicidal all the time. No, I'm not. I'm really not.
Okay.
But because there was a girl, because I had a younger ex who I broke up with years and years earlier, and it took me years to get over it. It was still playing on my mind 4 years later every now and then.
Yeah.
And I was convinced that when I was off my face at the time that the guy I was living with, Smithy, the drug dealer, had something to do with that.
With the breakup?
With the fact that we'd broken up. Not the fact that I smashed my ex's window when he got a restraining order and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't that. He thought he was, meth is also about not taking responsibility for things.
Okay.
But there was a girl who came to the house who was kind of like, she was real trashy like he was. And my ex was sort of little and small framed and similar colouring. And I've just looked at her one night and gone, that's him.
No.
That's him. And
wow.
Everything. And she was the girlfriend of this guy who we're living with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, they're doing this right under my nose. They're bringing it in. They're going, he won't even notice that that's Thomas now. And then I'm like, and then they've turned him into a woman. And then I've heard him say, this guy, and I wasn't sure about it, but this guy I was living with, I heard him say in conversation, I'll have a bit of both. And I'm like, bit of both? It's...
the female, male.
Transgender woman.
Yes.
It's a bit of both. That's what he's referring to. It is.
Wow.
And so I've then developed a whole plot in my mind about how they did this. Oh, they'd seen me with Thomas a few times and they've gone, he'd make a great woman that we could... or make love to, if you like.
Wow.
So let's wait for them to break up and then we'll get in his ear and we'll turn him into a woman. So that made me feel homicidal.
I bet.
And then I got over that, but then it would come back every now and then. And one day she walked in and I was looking at her and I'm like, he does look very much like a woman, but not the shoes. So I walked up to her and I said, the shoes aren't working. And I'm not that sort of gay guy going, but I was kind of like the shoes don't work sort of thing. Like everything else is convincing, but not the shoes.
Yeah. So had you been a different person, I don't want to say you could have killed her, but.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
If you had become more homicidal, you could have potentially murdered this random who's walked into your house because you thought it was your ex in drag and wow.
Yeah, exactly. So
and meanwhile, is Smithy, who's also living with you, who's the dealer, is he also having these kind of delusions about you, do you think?
To an extent, he was starting to. So he would masturbate compulsively. He would just sit there and just... I can't.
Oh, wow. We all know what the mime was there.
Yeah, and what? It was just...
In front of you?
Yeah, in front of... And because he was just... He was a bit sort of creepy anyway, but he had all these things that he found sexually exciting that were taboo kind of a while ago.
Ugh.
You know, like touching another man's penis. Imagine that. You know? imagine having someone up my ass. Hey, imagine that. That's all right. You can do that if you want.
I can imagine that. Yeah.
I mean, lots of people do that. You can go down the sauna or whatever, get a grinder out. That's fine.
Yeah.
I don't think people care anymore.
No.
Sort of thing. But it'd
but
be
for
like,
him, that
oh.
was crazy.
Oh, yeah, that was crazy.
Crazy. As if anyone would actually do that. And you said a minute ago that you masturbated for 16 hours.
Yep.
That sounds painful.
Well, how do you think I was masturbating?
Well, even, I mean, even if you're masturbating very kindly, it still feels like for 16 hours, chafing would be an issue.
No, it wasn't for some reason.
I don't
know how that...
Using moisturiser.
But what he would do is he would sit there and have these sexual fantasies out loud of, oh, imagine having some guy tether me X or something like that.
Right.
And then I'd sort of go, I might go and, like, leave the house for the next week while you get that out of your system.
Yeah.
I didn't actually. I talked it up, so I'd just be like, oh, yeah, so that's really interesting. I might do that, but can I have a bong in the meantime while I think about it?
Right.
Or can I have, you know... Another one of your, what do we call this? You know, he'd kind of get out the syringe and squirt him. You want some of this sort of thing? And I'd be like, oh yeah, I'll keep talking.
So I just free drugs.
I was flirting with him to get free drugs. Yeah, it was win-win all around. That's not in the book, by the way, and okay. I didn't just say that.
No.
But I got a lot of free drugs there by manipulating him sexually. And then it would all fall apart the next day, and I'd make out I wasn't. You know, he'd be like, you sort of promised. I'm like, no, I didn't. Oh, you must have misinterpreted me.
You promised that you might?
Oh, well, like you sort of, I got the impression, you know, you were, and I'm just like, look, this is a little game here. You know, I'll sort of get as much out of you and I'll give as little in return.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little bit of a power struggle
Gosh,
going
you're
on
playing
there.
Dangerous
but
games.
Yeah, but I've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of stuff. And so he would go to so the next day would come and he'd be like, I reckon New Year's Eve and Beck was out in the yard with this guy and I didn't see them and I reckon he was tethering her. And I'd be like, no, that's what you're... Well, I didn't realise at the time, but later I was like, but no, he was fantasising about that.
And so that's become a real memory in
it's
his mind.
It's become real. So what I learnt was this fascinating continuum between fantasy and psychosis, that it's all just the one thing. It's all just fantasy. It's all just imagination. But at some point something clicks in your mind and you go, that really happened.
Yeah.
So you get the crazy artist with schizophrenia and all that kind of stuff. Like they're, in a way, it's hallucinations, isn't it?
Uh-huh. So do you have schizophrenia yourself?
No, I don't.
Right,
no.
Okay.
No.
But did you see a lot of psychosis as a kid? You're very familiar with it?
No, I didn't because, my uncle had a breakdown in his 30s. And tried to jump off the Westgate Bridge, and we were quite close to him. And then after that, he had he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, but he was just kind of catatonic from all the antipsychotics he took. But
and your grandpa, you never saw
I never met him. He committed suicide in the late 60s.
So he was a young man.
He was in his 40s, but he'd been in and out of psych wards most of his life.
Wow. That's heavy hanging over you. Were you scared of developing schizophrenia as a young man?
No, it wasn't really talked about with me. Okay. And I didn't really show any signs of it. I probably wouldn't have had psychotic episodes were it not for the drug use.
No, absolutely not. But I was just wondering if in the back of your mind, because my grandmother committed suicide and she had... they called it nerves at the time, but I don't know what we would diagnose it as now. But it always worried me during my drug use. I used to think, I don't want to flip out like she did. I just want to, you know, it was always in the back of my mind like it could happen because it had happened to her. So I just wondered if you had a similar worry.
With not really, because it was the same sort of, it was called war neurosis. Is what he had. We just thought it was trauma from the war, but it's not until later, and I've actually got for this book where I've actually spoken to family members about what the situation was that it's clear to me he had schizophrenia.
Yeah, you had a great good relationship with your parents as a kid.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, dramas.
Yeah, no real dramas.
Because eventually you phoned them, didn't you? When you're in this house and it's just spiraling and you're scared, I guess. That'd be fair to say?
Yeah, well, I also thought that they were in on the this whole my ex is now a woman sort of thing. So when I rang my dad, my slaughterman father, about who lives in Queensland and doesn't like Muslims and laid it out to him that I knew he was in on this plot to turn my ex-boyfriend into a woman.
Wow, what did he have to say? Have, oh, my God.
Oh, I'll put you onto your mum.
Oh,
so,
no. Oh, God.
So for a while, though, I also thought everybody was poisoning me. because one day after I'd sort of played this little game of sexual cat and mouse with Smithy, where I tried to get as much drugs out of him as possible without having to touch him, he'd sort of gone, yeah, well, I don't find you very attractive either. Go and have a look in the mirror. Look at yourself. And I'm like, no, that's not how to insult me. You should know that. But he went on about it for about 2 hours. And then when I finally looked in the mirror, I was like, oh, gee. And I had all scabs and lumps and blackened teeth and all that. And I thought, someone's poisoning me. He's had a change of heart.
Yeah.
He's finally told me, but he hasn't told me as such. He's just laid a hint because mum and dad are paying them because I've constantly been talking about killing them since I got in the house.
About killing your parents?
Yeah, because I regard them as money hoarders.
Wow.
So what I'd done is I'd come up with a plot that animal liberationists would go, because my parents, so my dad was a slaughterman, but then they later ran a piggery.
Yes.
So I thought, I'll make it look like it's animal liberationists.
You planned the murder of your parents.
Yeah, but it was all as a joke. But then because there was a different, you know, fantasy and reality sort of became messy at times.
Yeah.
And then I sort of got stuck on a loop about it, you know, pretending to talk to people on the phone. And it was all very much plotted out.
Wow.
But it was all for everybody else's amusement. But then I got a bit OCD with it.
Yes.
And so I thought he'd told them. So then they've gone, well, let's poison him. If we put it in his syringe, he won't know. He'll be none the wiser. I'm like, arsenic poison. I've seen it from Miss Marple. You know, it's, I know how this works. It's bit by bit by bit, you know. And so I rang them and threatened to kill them that time and then another couple of other times as well.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. So you're on the phone threatening to kill your parents. What's going on with them? What are they? Is your mum crying? I imagine. What's happening?
Well, I guess that's a good question. I probably haven't thought about that enough. I probably haven't thought it about from their point of view as much as what I should have.
Okay.
And I think that when you're in the throes of addiction and recovering,
you
don't do that. But when I finally came out of it and spoke to them about it, they kind of said, don't worry about it. We know that you're not normally like that anyway.
Wow. Okay. Because you did then go up there to recover, right?
I did go up there to recover, yes. And but then my relationship with them never recovered and they kicked me out after about 6 months because I got into trouble with the police up there.
The pole, yes. What did you do to the police?
Oh, this is going to make me sound... But when I was recovering, it's not something I'm very happy with that I did, but I used to go... Like, they have crap cafes up there. It's up in Bundaberg, right?
They do, yes.
And so they had the coffee club that I went up there to, and because I was gym crazy whenever I get out of a drug addiction, I go gym crazy and I'm very meticulous about what I'd eat. And so I wouldn't eat anything at the coffee club. I'd get low-fat yogurt, blueberries and almond and then mix it all together before I went to the gym and have a coffee. And I'd been doing that the last couple of days, but this time I didn't order the coffee. And then first, and so the manager came around the corner and said, you always come in here with your yogurt and you don't buy any of our food. And I'm like, because your food is, you know, you know. And because I was still very grandiose and sort of up myself because I hadn't fully recovered.
Yeah.
And then she's like, I don't want you eating it in here sort of thing. And I'm like, but I spend $5 on your crap coffees every day, you know, so on and so forth.
Yes.
So I've then stood up, thrown the yogurt on the ground, thrown the blueberries on the ground, jumped on it and then said to her, I think someone's made a mess down the back there. You might need to go and clean it up.
Right.
And then I walked that past. I left. But then I walked past. I've got to see what the fallout for this is. I've got to see what they're doing. And she got one of her bloody minions to clean it up.
Right.
And that infuriated me. And so I went back over. I go, why don't you clean it up? You're the one who created the whole situation through your rudeness. Right. And then she came forward towards me. And in that spur of the moment, I spat right in her eye.
Wow.
And so, and then I went, like a villain and left, right?
Now, that's assault, isn't it? Is that officially?
It is assault.
Yes,
but it
okay.
was not only is it assault, but it was also on the news up there. So,
oh, my God.
It was on the radio up there and I had, you know, people commenting on social media, throw the book at him. And so my parents are really appalled by that because it's a small place.
Yes.
And I got a community service order of 150 hours and all this kind of stuff. And we had an argument over that and gave them a serve, my mum, and then she kicked me out the next day. So then I was sleeping outside for a couple of nights. But it's Queensland.
Bundy. Yeah,
it's so
nice
it's nice and warm.
Yep.
But, you know those little things where you had to experiment when you were little and you're like, if you can only take five things to space or whatever. It was like that because I only had $7 left.
Yeah.
And I had to sleep outside for a couple of nights. So what did I buy? I bought insect repellent because there's mosquitoes everywhere and it's very hard to, but otherwise it wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
But then I had to go and see a social worker and then...
And my poor mama. How's she going now?
She's well. We haven't seen each other since then.
Really? But you've spoken?
I have spoken to her.
Okay. She might be a bit scared of you.
No, I don't know. She said, I don't know if she is or not, because she's a very strong personality.
Okay.
And my dad is, she's rough as guts.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And dad's sort of the second one, but he's a big muscly guy with tattoos everywhere, right?
Okay.
Or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But mum's the dominant one.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
And I was always petrified of her up until the last year.
Yeah, right.
And so, I don't know, she says she is, but I'm just like, but are you really? Because I've been petrified from you for a long time as well. I don't know, it's complicated.
It is complicated, yeah. When you're scared of a parent too, it's it informs your adult relationship, I think. Must have felt good for a bit to have her scared of you.
I don't know if she was. No. I don't know if she was scared of me, but
when
I
you were
certainly
threatening to kill her on the phone.
Oh, you mean
think,
there? Well, yeah. I was interstate. I don't know whether they were scared of me or not. I don't think they were. I think they thought I'd just gone crazy. But certainly outside of that, I don't threaten to kill because I'm normally just a real bitch.
Yeah, right.
I don't normally go to that, especially not with my mum. You know,
yeah.
I'm blushing now that I've said
that. I know, it's amazing.
But
it's
after
amazing. Of all your experiences, it's talk of your mum that's got you freaking out and blushing and scared.
Oh, it's because it's so personal, isn't
it?
Yeah,
yeah. And also, obviously, she's a powerful force in your life. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Luke Williams talks about his time in Melbourne's notorious guest house, the Gatwick, which I believe is going to be the location for The Block next year. Wait till you hear his description of it and imagine Keith whirling around in this environment. That's coming up on Australian True Crime. Luke Williams is an Australian journalist who likes to immerse himself in interesting situations. It's a polite way of putting it. One of those situations was full meth addiction, and this is his story. So how long does it take you to recover from meth addiction? Like, do you feel like you've recovered? Is your brain back together, or how long does it take?
It takes a long time.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a long time physically to recover. You can feel a bit jumpy and anxious afterwards. It takes a long time to mentally recover.
I would think so, yeah.
So for me, it was psychologically addictive. Doesn't really begin to explain it, does it?
I was
lost in a psychotic fantasy, and I think a lot of people are when they use crystal meth on a much smaller scale.
Yeah.
So
sorting back through what's real, what's not real, what really happened, what didn't, what was a memory, what was a psychosis, who are really my enemies, who aren't.
Yes.
All of that.
Exactly. And you have to, because you've been thinking that way for months and months, or sometimes years for some people, and you've been very grandiose, so you have to really reconstruct reality. And it's, and you might do that, but it's hard not to bring in some of those aspects of unhelpful thinking.
Yes.
The grandiosity, the sense of persecution, the lack of empathy.
Yeah.
It's really hard to even recognise that you're still in that state.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people in that state without any drugs at all. So
exactly.
It's hard for them to recognise that.
Exactly. Yeah. And in some ways that's what makes crystal meth a kind of metaphor for our times.
Yeah.
Because it's just an extreme egomaniacal version of things about society that we don't like, or we do like, or we kind of aspire to at the same time.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. All the things we want to be, confident, feel good about ourselves, energetic, all of those things. Yeah, you can understand why people initially go, where has this been all my life?
And able to focus on work.
Yeah, and feel great about life. When was this? When did you stop using?
That was in 2014. So after this was at the start of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
So then once I was living homeless,
clean. About a year and a half clean?
This was about 6 months clean. Okay. So midway through 2014, mm-hmm. what I was just talking about with what happened with the community service order was the start of 2015.
Right.
So I got my my social worker contacted my agent.
Oh my gosh.
And I got some money from the publisher. And I just thought, do you know what? I might just leave Queensland and not do my community service order and go overseas.
Yes, did you?
And I did, but I booked in some time ahead. And hello, Judge, I forget your name. What is your very nice man, whoever, magistrate, you know, have a nice life in Bundaberg dealing with traffic offences all day. I can't remember what your name is. But I thought what I'll do is because I've got, I had a period, because I wanted the cheapest flight. Yes. And so it was like 4 weeks ahead. So I thought I'll fly to Melbourne and I'll do the story I always wanted to do but never could be bothered. But now I have to, which is go and stay in the Gatwick boarding house for a month.
Yes.
So I thought win-win again.
Yes.
And while I was there, I used.
Of course you did though. Again, in that place, you're trying to recover from addiction and you put yourself in this place that's full of...
But you know, I didn't want to stop using drugs then.
Right, yeah.
Everybody else was telling me to. I had a very lovely drug counsellor in Bundaberg who was saying to me, you know, I can tell you're kind of salivating at night over this. And I said, yes. And she said, are you actually drooling over it? And I said, yes, I am. Because I just would like to have another hit of it. And I don't think it's a big deal if I just use it every now and then, as long as I don't go crazy on it. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
So I just thought, well, that's all right. It doesn't. And because I was getting stuff done and I was able to get material and get on the level with people who I otherwise wouldn't and get great stories out of it. And it seemed to be feeding my imagination and it was helping me on my way to becoming a rap star as well.
Of course. Let's not forget that. Your true calling, yes.
So when I walked in one night after I I'd used there a couple of times and there was something about the place.
The Gatwick is
a place where people who have got nowhere else to go can go, providing they can pay $200 a week.
Yes.
So you get
a lot of people straight from prison, a lot of people, just with nowhere else to go.
And there's something about the place. When you first walk in, it stinks. But the place, its bark is worse than its bite.
Yes.
And if you spend a long enough time, you kind of get into the rhythm of it. You kind of go, oh, this place is a bit horny too. You know, there's a bit of edge. And so I used to love, you know, going to my room and masturbate for 12 hours in there. I just feel like life at the Gatwick sort of thing.
Yeah, okay.
And but anyway, putting that to one side, I walked in one night drunk and I had started believing in the journey again, even in my waking days.
Okay.
And I'd met these girls in a bar in St Kilda who were kind of straight-laced, reasonably so, and they weren't drug users. And I started telling them about the journey and they believed it.
Oh, wow.
And they were like, oh, wow. And I'm like, yeah, you open like the creative part of your brain and all this. And they were real like I could just about start a cult sort of thing.
Yeah.
And anyway, I'd come back. And in the communal bathroom, there is an Indigenous lady in the mirror with a needle in her neck full of crystallized meth.
Yeah.
And I've gone up to her and said, why are you doing it in your neck? And she says, straight to the brain, brother.
Straight to the brain.
And then she introduces me to her daughter, who does the same thing, who's like in her early 20s. Uh-huh. And I'd met her before, this lady, and talked to her quite a lot and said, it's good stuff. It's good stuff. And she was, and I'm like, oh, you've talked me into it. And then so I've used that night and used way too much, given them a whole lot of stuff, given the guy who sits outside the 7-Eleven a whole lot of stuff as well.
What do you mean by stuff?
Crystal meth. Because they gave me too much when
I bought some, which
started to freak me out. So I just gave some to everyone. So,
wow.
And this was like Tuesday night, St Kilda sort of typical. And I've given some meth to the guy sitting outside the 7-Eleven and I've said, oh, now be my opportunity to interview him because he's normally such a grumpy, you know, give me some money sort of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said to me, I've said, oh, so how come you're homeless? And he's like, I wasn't always homeless. My dad was a musician and I used to be a musician and I performed under all these different names. And I said, oh, what names were they? And he says, I'll write them down for you in your notebook.
Yeah.
And it's all stuff like Lebo Lebo Lee, Jimmy Johnson, like just all this random Wolfie Wolfie Woo and all this stuff. And then he gets to the end of the list and he goes, David Bowie, Angry Anderson. And he's like, now look at me, I live on the streets. And I'm like, no wonder you're such an angry, you know, I would be too. He feels like he's lost this. Yeah. What he thinks now, I'd be interested to know.
Yeah.
And then I got into an argument with someone and said all this stuff I shouldn't have said, which I wouldn't be capable of backing up because I ordered more drugs but my bank account was empty.
Of course, yeah.
And so this caused it. You know, a bit of a kerfuffle.
Yes.
And then, because he was a real like, and then ripped his shirt off and started going, you know, wow. Right in my face. And I thought, I might just go upstairs and have a cup of tea now up in my Gatwick room and just wait for things to calm down before I can come back down.
Mm.
And then I've sat there for, I don't know, scene deleted sort of thing. I can't remember. But then it was sort of morning. And I'm like, yep, I was right. My laptop's been stolen. Yeah.
Right, of course.
The contents of my porn that I've been looking at, yes. Which is not illegal but not even really edgy, but, you know, you don't want people knowing about it, is on the news. Because I didn't tell them I was a journalist as well because I was like, well, I am a journalist but I also just need somewhere to live.
Yeah, right.
So I'm like, they've found out I'm a journalist.
Yes.
Because I've told them when I'm off my face.
Right. Right.
And the people who are running this place are in the mafia because they're Maltese. So, of course, everyone who's Maltese must be in the mafia in some way. And so they've organised to break into my room. They stole my laptop. Everything's on the news. All the silly stuff I do online, it's all on the news everywhere, just like in Bundaberg. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I had a repetition of this whole thing. And I've gone out to the St Kilda Crisis Centre because I know the lady, she's a novelist who works behind the desk there.
Yeah.
And I've gone, but she's not in there. And I've said, apparently, I don't know, because she just told me recently that I was telling her that there's messages coming from the clouds.
Oh, no.
To her manager. And then I'm sitting there outside. This woman comes up to me who's also Maltese in appearance, who so I think she's in the mob. And she's like, oh, what's wrong? You've lost your voice or something. Now, she's got two full eyes. And then she comes up to, then she says to me, I've lost one of my eyes, and then covers them up. And she's like, have you seen my eye? And I'm like, and I'm psychotic. And I'm like, what's she talking about? What was that guy talking about last night with the David Bowie stuff?
Yeah.
What's going on here? People are lying to me. They're all playing a trick on me. He's not David Bowie. Why did he say that? And why is she saying this? They're gonna stab me in the eye. They're gonna take my eye out.
Yeah.
So I've gone into the publishers. And I said, I understand why you don't want to publish the book because all my pornography's on the news. It's okay now.
Really,
I understand.
Did that?
Yeah, I did really,
you really
do that.
Went into your publisher's office.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I had a jumble of reasons why I went in there at the time as well. But that was one of the reasons. I thought people were killing me, all sorts, trying to kill me, all sorts of stuff. And then,
what did they say?
Well, they were like, what internet sort of history? And then I just went and told them all about my sexual fantasies and everything. And I was so embarrassed. But they were so great about it. And they just thought it was funny.
Okay.
And I was just so humiliated that day and discovered that my laptop was sitting in my room the whole time when I got back. And then I had to go to a homeless centre because I'd spent all my money on drugs for them to pay for my next week at the Gatwick.
Yeah.
And I'm surrounded by people who – one guy who's – you know, his mum had been shot by his dad and then his dad shot himself.
Yeah.
You know, my parents gave me money to go to university.
Yeah.
I'd had so many advantages in life that they hadn't, and now I was on the level with them for, like, how did that come about? It just seemed wrong to me that I was in that condition. And then I went overseas and...
To Thailand?
I went to Thailand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
again, sounds like a pretty loose place to go.
I did. I stayed in an art space for a few months, which was really great.
Yeah.
And then I ran out of money altogether.
Are you clean in Thailand?
I was clean,
wow.
but there was a lot of pot being smoked there.
That's
but that's
fine.
About it.
I'll
thank
cop
you.
That. I'll
thank
cop
you.
That, yeah.
Thank you for accepting that.
No worries.
But no, I didn't. I was starting to get over it then.
Great place to clean up. You're sweating it out. You're eating healthy food, fresh food, drinking a lot of water.
And I think I was lonely as well.
I bet.
All my friends were drug users,
yes.
So I was around other people. Who were sort of free thinking but not using drugs all the time. And then when I ran out of money again, I went north to Chiang Mai, which is 12 hours north of Bangkok. And I stayed in because they have temples you can go and stay in for free.
Yep.
And they feed you every day, but you've got to obey the rules, which
Buddhists,
is. Yes, which is no injection crystal meth,
yes.
no sort of prostituting yourself in order to get drugs,
no.
And no eating after midday. No cigarettes, no coffee, no nothing, no talking,
mm-hmm.
Just praying all day and meditating all day. So
intense.
Intense, but I thought I could do this. I did, and I got a lot out of it. And
you're a man of extremes, eh?
And it was like, the opposite way. It was the exact opposite of crystal meth.
But it was
meth.
Also extreme, isn't it? It feels like the thing that really captured your imagination was this other extreme.
Yes, you know? It was going absolutely the other way. Yeah. And there was a religious aspect to that and a spiritual. And you do all these rituals with the monk where you hand them flowers and you bow. And there's a real ritualized aspect too, especially intravenous drug use with other people.
Yeah, you know what? A lot of people don't realize that there is a big ritualistic element to intravenous drug use. It's getting your kit, opening your kit, pulling it out, getting the water. All of that stuff is very ritualistic, isn't it? You look forward to that almost as much as... It's the drug.
You do. And when you're in the house of other people doing that, you feel like you're really missing out because you're almost sharing, you're not technically sharing blood, but you're breaking skin with people together.
Yes.
And, you know, we don't have those sort of rituals in our life now. And we certainly don't have rituals based around abstinence and going without things like Lent and so forth.
Yeah. So are you still clean? Have you been clean since then?
Clean since then. So
which
that's
is how long now?
That's 18 months
ago.
And I realised the egomania and the delusions at the heart of all sorts of different neuroses.
Yeah.
If you're insane in any way, it's probably linked to some sort of delusion that you have.
Yeah.
And
so can I ask you then, take you back to what do you think, how is it that you ended up in the Gatwick with those people, you know? Big picture stuff. How is it that you, Luke, from what sounds like a nice home where you were well taken care of and they gave you money to go to uni, you're very smart, you're very creative.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Do you have any idea as to how you ended up in the Gatwick?
Well, if I was still living in Australia, I probably still would be at the Gatwick because I can't afford to rent a house here.
Okay.
Genuine economics.
But, I mean, you also could still be a lawyer. So what is it like psychologically, spiritually about you that is more comfortable in the Gatwick than in a law firm?
Because I get to sleep in every day at the Gatwick. And I don't have all those other commitments. But I just think because the editors I was speaking to when I was already in the story were like, oh, scary. And again, I'm telling you now, I was second or third in charge by a week in.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'd find going to the Walkley scary. Okay. I'd find that really scary because I'd feel
awards,
like I would – yeah, sorry, the Big Journalism Awards. I'd feel like I wasn't dressed properly or I'd say something wrong or I'd say something offensive to somebody.
Yeah.
But I've always ran with – not always, but ever since I came out at school and everyone said, congratulations, that's fantastic, especially my male friends. Mm. They were really excited and said, actually, seeing as though your pencil case is right next to us right now, why don't we just throw it on the ground and you can go and sit somewhere else, you poofed up.
Really?
Yeah, so I had that and I was in kind of the popular group and one of the popular boys and wanted to be one of the cool ones and whatnot, kind of a minion in the popular group. And
then when you came out, you were kicked out of it.
Yeah, well, I didn't come out. Everyone had found out about all the under-the-table sort of stuff I'd been doing since about grade five.
Oh.
And so nobody wanted anything to do with me because they didn't want to be associated with. And then when that happened... even the people sort of below them on the social ladder then also started picking on me because it was fun to see me fall. And then I had no protection at a school and so I had groups of guys bully me, punch me, throw me into poles, push me on the ground. And one day I was in PE and I felt a big thump in my back and I turned around and it was a kid with muscular dystrophy and he'd thrown a basketball at me and he goes, I hate poofters. Oh, sorry, I'll just spat everywhere.
I don't mind, I'll take the spat. That's
say,
fine.
I'm so sorry. It's I feel fine. So embarrassed.
Don't feel embarrassed.
That.
It's fine.
So you can imagine sort of that humiliation. And after that, the only people who would kind of hang around me were all the real misfits, who were all the druggos from the age of about 14 onwards.
Yeah.
So they have a certain way of speaking and certain sense of humour and a certain way about them that I just felt more comfortable in than in mainstream society. And this, where I've been doing this homeless story this week, I've been taken as homeless straight away as soon as I've sat down next to them. And in fact, I've told one lady that I'm a journalist and she doesn't believe me. She thinks I've got delusions of grandeur and she's got me a jacket and she's getting me shoes.
Yeah.
And she's just like, you're going to have to just be honest with the social workers and tell them that you're homeless. Because we've got that addiction and we've got that thing in common.
Yeah.
I've always ran with that crowd. I've always felt more comfortable and I've always felt really constrained and bored even by conventional sort of society.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like that you cop to the boredom element too. It's like, I get the bullying, I get the your homophobia, but I like that you say, and also it's boring, and this life that I'm living now is not boring.
No, I love it. Yeah. I have so much fun, and I'd be doing this stuff for fun anyway, and it's really doesn't feel brave to me because it's the kind of stuff I do anyway. And now I just, if I had to know earlier, I could have had a career trajectory earlier, but I didn't realise people would be so interested in all this. I kept it a secret for so long.
Luke's book about his meth adventure is called Ice Age, A Journey into Crystal Meth Addiction. It's excellent and it's available now. The best way to keep up with Luke and his many movements is to follow him on Twitter, where he is @LukeWilliamsJ.